when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain. I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
And I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
G'day, Mark Kenny here, and thanks for joining us again on Democracy Sausage, which, as you know, comes each week from the ANU, Australian National University. I'm from the Australian Studies Institute within said university and the School of Politics and International Relations as well, as is the wonderful Dr. Maria Tiflaga, political scientist, a senior lecturer in SPIR, the School of Politics and International Relations. Maria, good to see you again.
Hi. Hi, everyone.
Now, just at this point, I wanted to give a shout out just quickly to the students of the Elections and Political Behaviour and Public Opinion Winter Intensive course that was that is being given on campus at the moment. I gave a lecture there yesterday morning on issues associated with particularly media and political campaigns and what it's like for journalists in election campaigns and the like. But I was just so impressed with the quality of the discussion that occurred in the question time afterwards. You know, I had so many really good questions put to me, and it was, you know, we were just talking before we came on about life on campus and the, you know, the changes that have, you know, unfortunately been inflicted on many places, and campuses have been particularly affected by the COVID, and that's all, you know, coming back now. But it was just great to have, you know, a pretty full lecture theatre and to get those really great questions. I mean, you're probably well aware of this, Maria, as well, in terms of your courses that you're teaching.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it has been a hard time for universities, but it has been really encouraging to see students come back on campus, and it's certainly much easier to teach in person, I find, than online.
Yeah, and it's, well, exactly. It's just such a richer experience, such a more interactive and spontaneous experience, I think. And thanks to Professor Ian McAllister and Dr. Katrine Beauregard, who invited me to that, because they've, of course, been on Democracy Sausage in their separate capacities, and we'll have to think about ways in which we can engage
Absolutely.
With them again, because great experts. Today, though, Maria, we're going to be talking to the former Liberal Senator, former Attorney General and former High Commissioner to the UK from Australia, now turned Professor of National Security at the ANU, George Brandis. Welcome, George.
Hi, how are you?
I'm really, really well, thank you, and it's good to talk to you. It's been quite a while. Of course, I don't think we spoke at all during your time over in the UK.
But, no, I don't think so.
Yeah, it's really, really great to have a chance to talk to you, particularly because you have taken up this role also as a columnist with the Nine newspapers.
Yeah.
Can I first congratulate you on those columns, because I think as is the case with all columnists, and I'm one as well, you know, not everyone always agrees with you, and I certainly don't always agree with the arguments you put, but I will say this, you put them very well and you pass that really critical first test, which is you're always interesting. And can I just congratulate you on that?
But, thank you.
There's a number of issues that that you've covered in recent times, things like Ukraine, the Liberal Party. You haven't covered cricket and the Ashes yet, the most recent controversy.
No, I thought I'd leave that to others. I actually was watching live when that happened.
And, right.
For what it's worth, I think what happened in the long room is much more revealing than anything that happened on the pitch. When that stumping occurred, I didn't even understand what the fuss was about,
right,
because I've never been much of a sportsman, but I remember when I was like Anthony Albanese said, when I was playing cricket as a schoolboy, I mean, you know, one of the rules was you don't wander out of your crease. And if you're stumped, then that was what happens to you. And I was very surprised that that was regarded as unsporting conduct.
Yes, well, I mean, yeah, it was amazing, the response to it, because
absurd.
There was, but it was interesting. I heard Waleed and Scott talking about this on the Minefield on RN, a podcast I also enjoy, or a radio program I also enjoy. Scott was not getting it at all because he's basically of American heritage, and cricket is not sort of steeped in his mind, and he's not a particularly enthusiastic user of sports metaphors and that kind of thing, as is the case with many of us. Waleed, on the other hand, was most exercised about it, and there was a lot of interesting discussion about the whole notion of, you know, the relationship and the balance between things that are rules and things that are conventions, you know, etiquette and ethics and the what Scott called the ethos of the game as distinct from the rules. And I thought it's quite a fascinating frame, you know, and it was pretty obvious in their discussion. Waleed was essentially trying to kind of, you know, metaphorically compare that with politics and, you know, some of the stories that have been running as well there. So it is a fascinating area.
Well, particularly since when you consider that in the second test, for an entire session, there was bouncer after bouncer,
yes,
which was designed to intimidate and physically hurt the batsman.
Yeah.
And that was not regarded as unsporting.
Yeah.
But to get somebody out entirely within the rules because of their inadvertence was, I'm entirely 100%. I don't even think there are two points of view here. I'm 100% on the side of the Australian, that the Australians did the right thing, and the British, particularly the people in the long room at Lord's, behaved very, very
abominably.
Badly. Abominably.
And Gideon Haig rather nailed them when he described them as puce-faced, dim bulb snobs. yelling at Usman Khawaja, a man of colour, a gentleman of colour, as you know.
But it wasn't just Usman Khawaja.
No, it wasn't.
The entire team.
It was. But there was an argument that some of them singled him out. I'm not sure why. Perhaps because he engaged with them.
I think if you look at the vision of it, he engaged and sort of gave some chat back.
Yeah, but it would have been polite. I mean, that's the nature of the man. And
I don't know.
There ought to have been. And it's the only place where, Maria, where when the bats, you know, this is the home of cricket, Lords, right? This is not just anything. This is the place where the rules, the very rules that were used to have this wicket occur, are set by Lords, you know, by the MCC, the Marylebone Cricket Club.
Well, I'm
definitely. It's the only place where when you get out, you know, the two teams go through this long room, as George was saying, where all the members are, all these characters in pinstriped jackets. And
I'm definitely the Scott Stevens of this conversation. But I guess I did have two observations which I thought were interesting. Like, it is interesting that British political actors and commentators do tend to think that Australians are very sort of winner takes all and gung-ho compared to them to themselves, which probably goes to the sort of self-image that they created themselves. And I also just, the only thing I did really see about it was, you know, Rishi Sunak weighing in, and I just sort of thought, well, you know, that's really, you must be desperate if that's what it's sort of
desperate.
Coming to, you know, that, yeah, you've got
well,
to weigh
in
onto
the cricket.
He's quite
desperate, but he's also a massive cricket fan.
And a cricketer himself.
Yeah,
When he lost the Tory leadership during the brief Truss administration and he wasn't appointed to cabinet by her, the first thing he said he was going to try out for his local cricket side in Yorkshire. So,
yes.
I mean, he's a very passionate cricket person, Rishi Sunak.
I was listening in the middle of the night, as one does, you know, to the cricket app, ABC cricket app, and listening to it. And at one stage I must have dozed off and I woke up and there was this interview going on, long form interview going on, and I didn't actually know who it was he was talking at first. And he was telling that story and about going back there, and it was gently told by someone in the local village, look, don't assume that you'll automatically be selected here. This is pretty competitive. I mean, this is someone who is now, you know, Prime Minister of the country. And I thought that was just a fascinating.
Yeah, I don't think you would have had such a cricket nut in 10 Downing Street since John Major.
No, that's probably right. But, you know, going to Maria's point, Australia does have this reputation. There was Sandpapergate. There was the underarm bowling incident. There is that sort of sense of Australia looking at the rules and you know, not looking at the ethos, I suppose.
Well, yeah, I think that's a very poor metaphor, because for those who try to use it, because
abrasive metaphor, we'll call it.
Sandpaper Gate was cheating.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, black and white cheating, yeah. Disgraceful.
Yeah.
The Trevor Chappell incident all those years ago of bowling underarm was so obviously a distortion of the rules that it was amounted, in my view, to cheating.
Mm.
But this incident, this episode, was entirely not only within the rules, but the way I always understood cricket was orthodox.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Now, a lot of people are listening to this thing, why are they talking about cricket all the time? So let's talk about...
Well, I was the sports minister, right? I know this stuff.
Well, that's true. I should have said that. Yeah, that's very true. But look, you've written recently about The Voice and you wrote a piece, I think it's sitting there, Seven Ways to Essentially Revive It or Rescue It, the Yes campaign. And you've called the campaign, I think it was, terrible and tone deaf.
Yeah.
Is that still your view?
It is. In fact, I mean, I was watching Linda Burney's speech to the National Press Club last week, and it was almost as if she doubled down on, because I think I said in the last paragraph of that column, I bet nobody in the Yes campaign takes the blind bit of difference of these ideas. And it was almost as if Linda Burney was determined to make all the mistakes again, because I do think that the Yes campaign has been patronising. I think it has been, there's been a lot of moral bullying and shaming people into thinking they're doing the right thing if they vote no. And that kind of misses the point. And the point, the way I would put it, Mark, though it's not what I said in the column you refer to, is that unlike elections, referendums are not binary, at least not in the campaign phase, for this reason. In an election, ultimately, people have to choose between Labor and Coalition. I mean, through the preference system, they're forced to that choice ultimately. Mm. And that's not to say that there aren't undecided people. But ultimately, they decide, well, do we vote for the Coalition? Do we vote for Labor? Do we vote for a change of government? Do we vote to return the incumbent government? But in referenda, there are really three groups. Or another way of putting the same point would be to say that the undecided group has a different character. So you're always going to have the people who are in favour of the proposition. You're always going to have the people who are opposed to the proposition. But the undecided group is different for two reasons. First of all, because it's almost always a lot bigger in referenda as people become aware of what this is all about. But secondly, there is a large number of people, in my view, in that undecided group who may be inclined to vote yes but aren't sure.
Mm-hmm.
And within that, among those, the default choice is to vote no, not because they're necessarily opposed to the yes, the proposition, the yes point of view, but because they're not sure and the default position is the precautionary position of voting no. And that, I think, is the real dynamic of a referendum campaign, and it's those people who are not being addressed.
Yeah. You list a number of ways in which the campaign can change. You talk about being respectful. You talk about publishing an exposure draft of the Voice structure. You say quite pointedly, as a former Attorney General, you say quite confidently that an exposure draft would exist.
I'm sure it would. Or if not an exposure draft, a document that amounts to much the same thing,
yeah.
Drafting instructions or whatever. And
would that actually be helpful?
Of course it would. But, I mean, and I draw upon my experience. You know, I ran the parliamentary tactics, as you know, for the marriage equality legislation, and I was a strong advocate for marriage equality, but I was also very mindful of the fact how easy any new and controversial proposition is to mess up. And at quite an early stage, long before it went to the parliament, I said to Malcolm Turnbull, what we should do is we should have an exposure draft so that people will be able to see what this will look like. And it's not as simple as it sounds, because marriage is, particularly when you get into areas like the recognition of foreign marriages, for instance, is actually quite a legally complex area. It's not simply should gay people be allowed to marry. That was the core question, but it wasn't the only legal issue. Now, and I remember saying, you know, if we don't publish, say, this is exactly what the legislation is going to look like, then the people who are opposed to it, the Tony Abbotts, the Corey Bernardis, all those sorts of people are going to say, what are they really hiding? Now, ultimately, it wasn't that exposure draft that was passed. It was a bill that Senator Dean Smith introduced, but we gave him the exposure draft and he drew heavily upon it, certainly all the technical aspects. And after the main proposition was adopted by the Senate, then I moved all the technical amendments that incorporated and built into his bill the exposure draft technical stuff. But my point is, there is no virtue in opening a flank to yourself to allow the people who are campaigning for no to say, what are they hiding?
Yeah, but I guess I sort of wonder, like, okay, say we accept your point, you publish the exposure draft and, you know, there's nothing to be seen here anymore, you know, everything is out in the open. I mean, given the way the proponents of no have sort of been prosecuting their case, I don't really see how that will really make any material difference. They seem to sort of shift the goalposts with every new piece of information that comes forward. So apart from a sort of, I suppose, like covering off all bases, I mean, I don't really see how it will actually help really shift the dial on the debate.
Well, there is an old-fashioned notion which usually gets a pretty favourable reception in political discussion called transparency. Now, we're not talking about a national security document or a document for which there are other reasons, other policy reasons why it ought to be kept confidential. We're talking about the draft of a document that's about to be put to the parliament itself. And one of the reasons this seems to be going down is because the No campaign is pointing out to the undecideds in particular, well, you don't know what's in it. I think given that this is not of its nature a confidential document, it's a document that at some stage of the process is going to be the bill itself. The only reason for keeping it confidential, in my view, is the political tactical reason that if you publish it now, as kind of as you just said, Maria, the No case might make merry with it. Well, to which my response is, I think, you know, and I've run campaigns, you know, I'm not unfamiliar with the way voters think. I think there is more peril for the yes case in exposing itself to the what are we hiding argument than there is for the yes case in publishing the document and letting the no case sort of pick at it. Because if they do, as they would, of course, as they legitimately would, the Prime Minister could reply, well, okay, this is a matter for the Parliament to discuss and we're not saying, particularly where the government doesn't have a majority in the Senate, we're not saying that there won't be the capacity for parliamentary, you know, putting in this on the parliamentary anvil and beating out of it bits that should be reviewed.
I mean, in a sense, that goes to the crux of the argument anyway, doesn't it? Which is that this is a body that would be subordinate to the parliament. So to that extent, I suppose there's some logic in what you're saying, even tactically, because It allows the government to, or the yes case, the proponents to say, well, look, this is a body that would be entirely created by the parliament, would be entirely answerable to the parliament. That said, as Maria says, the no case has been unscrupulous here in so many ways. I mean, you talk about the, you know, what you call a sanctimonious tone that the yes advocates have taken, but no, the no case has been absolutely outrageous. They've talked about people stealing your land. They've talked about a veto power that it doesn't have. We've seen the leader of the opposition talking about Canberra academics and elite, the Canberra voice, which is just wrong. There's the claim that it's racist, that it would establish apartheid in Australia. This is, social media is coursing with this kind of bile, and there's no doubt that were this exposure draft, which, as you say, would be subject to all this subsequent parliamentary process if the referendum gets up. Would be subject to considerable change, and it would probably be vastly misrepresented in what is a pretty disreputable sort of public debate.
Well, Mark, I take all that on board, and I point out that, I mean, there's no sort of generic no case. There are lots of, as with the yes case too, there are lots of points on the spectrum between
the rat bag
arguments from both the yes and the no case. The yes people saying, if you vote against this, you're a racist, which is a disgraceful thing.
Yeah, but I haven't seen anyone saying that. I constantly hear no people saying that yes people are saying that, but I don't see it anywhere on social media. I've not seen anyone actually saying
it on social media. I've seen it on social
media.
Well,
it's vastly outnumbered by the no people who are advocating this argument that it's racist inherently.
Well, do you think Peter Dutton is advocating that when he said re-racialising the Constitution?
Think he was feeding that. I think that was a dog whistle.
What he was – but – well, you may think that, but I think what he said, calling attention to the fact that this introduces – a racial distinction into an element of the Constitution, was a point that obviously ought to be made in the argument from the no cases point of view.
Well, what it actually does is it recognises there were people here before white settlement, and that they were disenfranchised, they were dispossessed, and there has been a whole series of intergenerational sequelae from that, and we know about, and this is about.
Well, if that's what all it did, you'd be right. But I mean, I think we need to unpick that, Mark. We need to distinguish between constitutional recognition, an idea which, by the way, had its genesis with John Howard in the 1990s, and the voice as the most appropriate way to effectuate that objective. Now, in my own view, is that if the proposition merely were, should Indigenous people be recognised in the Constitution, that has overwhelming support of the Australian people.
But doesn't that re-racialise, to use that language?
Let me come to that. But I think that a proposition like that would have 1967 levels of support in the community. But that issue and the voice have been merged. And I think the no people like, you know, let's call them the respectable no people, people like Senator Price and Warren Mundine and the mainstream no people, I think they're perfectly entitled to make the point whether you, even if you agree with Indigenous recognition, this is not the way to go about it.
All right. Well, you talked about it having greater transparency. What can I ask you what your position is on it? Because, I mean, giving advice, seven ways to rescue the campaign, it sets up the idea that you would like to see it rescued, but would you?
Well, I would like to see more transparency. I mean, I haven't publicly declared my own position because I'm still watching the debate. I mean, the column you referred to was a criticism of both the political tactics and more specifically the tone of the Yes campaign. It wasn't a critique of the proposal itself.
Yeah.
But for me, it did read like there was a whole lot
of reasons not to vote for it.
But for me, my point was – all the reasons not to vote for it are being fed by the Yes people with their tone-deaf campaign. For me, the big issue is transparency, I have to say.
Yeah. Okay. Let's take a break there and come back in a moment. Talk about some other matters.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire,
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back. Now, we're talking with George Brandis and Maria Tafaga on Democracy Sausage. As you know, it's not a radio program, so I guess you're pretty familiar with what you've logged into. George Brandis, the Prime Minister's in Europe at the moment. He's been in Germany, in Berlin. He's going to Vilnius in Lithuania for this special NATO conference. Obviously, Ukraine is the dominant issue there. You've written about Ukraine and made some, I think, very persuasive points about just the sort of diplomatic disaster and strategic disaster that it has been for Russia, in the sense that it has united Europe and in the sense that it's been militarily much, much harder and, of course, in the end has sort of been rolling backwards as much as forwards in recent times. How do you think it's going now? I mean, and what do you think will come out of this this you know, expansion of NATO, or the sort of almost kind of the rejuvenation of NATO? It's brought some criticism from Paul Keating, of course.
Paul Keating sounds increasingly mad, frankly, given some of the language he used.
He's not a fan of Jens Stoltenberg, is he? The director general called him supreme fool.
Yeah, well,
for expanding into or for sort of seeking to extend its influence into Asia.
This is kind of King Lear-like madness that we're hearing from Paul Keating these days. Now, obviously, the thing that it will be at the front of everybody's mind in Vilnius will be Ukraine. But there are a lot of issues that hang off that too, and this is something not to be lost sight of. Another is Sweden's membership of NATO. Now, Sweden wouldn't have reversed its policy and sought to become a member of NATO but for the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But the fact that Sweden's membership of NATO is being objected to by Turkey is very interesting, and that throws into particular relief the important and increasingly almost anomalous role of Turkey within NATO, because, I mean, NATO, on the one hand, is seeking solidarity against Russia in its invasion of Ukraine. On the other hand, Recep Tayyip Erdogan is promoting himself as a potential
interlocutor between
Putin and Zelensky, and supplying arms to both sides or comfort to both sides. So, the reason I go to that example is to make the point that it's not just about do we all stand together against Ukraine, which is sort of the meta narrative
here.
That is the meta narrative here. But there is a lot of important political implications within the dynamics of NATO itself that are engaged. And then, of course, there is the question of to what extent nations in our hemisphere are involved. Now, I think Mr. Albanese absolutely made the right decision to go to Vilnius. Mm-hmm. I think it was a bad mistake for him initially to hesitate. This is a no-brainer that a nation like Australia, a G20 nation, a Five Eyes member, a forward-leaning liberal democracy, should stand in absolute solidarity with NATO in defending in its support for Ukraine against this violent, outrageous breach of international law. But once again, the relationship between NATO and the liberal democracies of the Eastern Hemisphere, of the Indo-Pacific, is another broader issue that this illuminates.
Yeah. And I guess it was some of that to which Keating was referring which he's quite inflamed about. But Maria, in a lot of ways, I mean, yes, we see all these manifestations, NATO sort of rejuvenated, strengthened, enlarged, with some very significant implications associated with that. And we see the mismatch between Turkey and most of the other members in some of those values questions. It's a problem with Sweden, for example, and the reason it's been holding up Sweden's application is mostly over actions of extreme anti-Islam sentiment being expressed in Sweden, people burning the Quran and disrespecting it and so forth. But, you know, that goes to a sort of a values question as well, doesn't it, about the extent to which governments are responsible for the actions of citizens and whether in a liberal democracy governments should be clamping down on free speech or right to protest or whatever. So there's so many issues involved here, but it does look like now a deal has been done. The Americans have made it very clear to Erdogan that they want to see Sweden's application progressed. It's all pretty messy, and it's kind of big strategic policy decisions being made in a sense on the run as a result of this war.
Well, I guess that's what happens when you've got a revisionist conflict that is happening. I mean, I can't pretend to have the expertise of George here on the sort of power politics within NATO, though it has been interesting to watch Turkey, I guess, sort of flex its muscles on this issue. And you know, I think it's done that actually quite successfully.
Mm. Well, it may end up with some F-16s as a result of it, I think. Yeah.
Precisely. And I mean, and you know, and Turkey has always actually been quite successful at playing off various powers within the region.
I think there
were
some Turkish missiles, weren't there, back in the Cuban Missile Crisis that ended up being removed, I think.
That was the deal that Bobby Kennedy did.
It was sort of subsequent
to it. Off balance sheet, as it were.
It was off balance sheet. Yeah.
That was not owned up to at the time and happened sort of discreetly 6 months later, but that was how the crisis was diffused.
Yeah, and it does go to that sort of role you're both talking about Turkey's sort of geographic position as well, you know, sitting there between Europe and Asia and between East and West as well to an extent in a kind of a geopolitical sense. Really a kind of a fascinating thing. But the NATO hasn't exactly covered itself in glory here, or at least the West in terms of its positioning on NATO hasn't, because, you know, we saw George Bush in 2008 talking about Ukraine being made a member, and there was a whole lot of sound strategic reasons, and Paul Keating would certainly agree with this part, of why Ukraine shouldn't be a member or wasn't allowed to be a member, and why that was never progressed beyond that, and why subsequent signalling was that Ukraine wouldn't be a member simply because it, you know, was in this old sphere of influence thing. It was actually shared a border with Russia, part of the old Soviet Union. It was thought to be an unnecessary provocation and so forth. In the end, Putin decided that there was enough of this as a possibility to use it, George, as a justification for the invasion, and the net result is it could come about anyway, because that's now a live issue in Vilnius as well.
Well, it all depends how far back in history you want to wind back. I mean, in the late 1980s, after the first President Bush was elected in 1988, but before the Soviet Union fell and they were dealing with Gorbachev, there were conversations, particularly with James Baker, the Secretary of State, and Gorbachev and Shevardnadze, his the foreign minister. And in those conversations, there was the American, I don't know if it's right to characterize it as a reassurance, but certainly an observation that there was no intention or expectation that NATO would extend to Ukraine. And now this is on either side of the collapse of the Soviet Union, while the thing is dismembering. And the conversation that I'm referring to must have been during the process of the old Soviet Union being dismembered. But, I mean, go back a century or more, there was a separate Ukrainian delegation at the peace talks with Germany, which produced the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, so separate from Russia. So this issue of Ukraine's distinctness from Moscow and the nature of its engagement with the West is a very, I mean, it goes It's got yeah. a long history.
Ukraine, you know, I mean, like the Ukrainian sort of historical advocates would sort of say that they were a big loser, actually one of the biggest losers out of the Treaty of Versailles, for example, because, you know, its territory was contested by Poland, which, you know, so Lviv was Lvov until the Second World War, for example. You know, the Soviets claimed certain parts of what is now Ukraine and you know, parts of it used to be in the Austro-Hungarian Empire itself. So that is actually a very old Tsarist narrative that Ukraine is a part of Russia, and that this whole idea of Little Russia is actually like a historical process that the Russian Empire tried to do in terms of sort of trying to extinguish that sort of national identity within Ukraine. And that's why you sort of see that very deeply political debate about the Ukrainian language and the use of Ukraine as a language as opposed to Russian, you know, and how it divides the East and the West. So
there's a really interesting piece that Dennis Glover has written in the most recent Australian Foreign Affairs, wherein he likens the situation, very much a supporter of the current muscling up by the West and treating this threat seriously, Dennis Glover is, but he makes a very persuasive sort of comparison with the failure of democracies to intervene and to supply arms or to supply any sort of support really at all to the Spanish Republicans in 1938, and how that emboldened Hitler and, you know, things that tumbled from there, and says, you know, that's the history that we need to be comparing here. We need to be thinking about, and he says, you know, to be fair, that is what democracies now are doing. They are recognizing that to allow Russia to get away with what it's doing in Ukraine, which they, let's be honest, had done in 2014 in relation to the Crimea, to allow it to go further and do this would just be unconscionable. And that line needs to be drawn in the sand.
I haven't read Dennis Glover's article, but I'm a bit reluctant to draw comparisons between what's happening in Ukraine now and the Spanish Civil War. I mean, for a start, what's happening in Ukraine now isn't a civil war. It's an invasion. And secondly, if you go back to the Spanish Civil War, I mean, you know, the received view for decades was that the Francoists were the bad guys and the revolutionaries supported by the international brigades were the good guys. There's been a lot of revisionist history.
Well, there might have been.
They were kind of both bad
guys. There might have been, but there was actually a committee established in Europe which agreed that there would be no support given to either side, but the Germans and the Italians continued to supply very sophisticated arms to the Francoists, and actually tried out their new arms. We know with, you know, the bombing of civilian populations, the terror bombing as it was called, of civilian populations like Guernica.
Yep.
All of these things were tried by using German and Italian arms and support, while the French and the English and the Americans maintained this sort of strict hands-off approach. Everyone knew it was going on but didn't do anything about it.
Look, from my historical memory, I think that's true, but I think there were other even clearer signals of the weakness of the West at the time, in particular the failure to stand up for the Treaty of Locarno and the acquiescence in the Italian invasion of Abyssinia in the 1930s were even clearer signals of the weakness.
I agree, but there's only a matter of months between the fall of the Republicans in Spain and the move on Czechoslovakia by Hitler, and we know relatively short period after that we were in a global war situation. So yes, there are always going to be differences. That's always the nature of historical comparisons or lessons. But I think it's an interesting one. It's not the same one that some people have been arguing about, sort of a more general idea of, you know, think about the 1930s when talking about China or whatever. But it does have implications for what lessons Xi Jinping, for example, would take were the West not to take a very strong line in Ukraine. What lesson would Xi Jinping take from that in relation to Taiwan? That's, you know, one of the arguments.
Sure, but I mean, I think most people were surprised, frankly, at how strong the line the West took was. I mean, there was a lot of talk in advance of the invasion that, you know, one of its strategic or geopolitical objective was to break the West and to divide the West. And, you know, there were some, Macron being one, who were much more reluctant to take a strong line than others. And although his name is now going through a period of unpopularity, there's no question whatsoever that the Western leader who took the strongest and most forward-leaning view was Boris Johnson.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah, but I don't think we can discount the fact that the debacle that was that invasion is actually one of the reasons why the West sort of rallied. I think if that invasion had been more successful, I'm not sure we would have necessarily have seen the same.
No, I think you're wrong about that, Maria. I mean, when you say the West, perhaps some elements of the West but no doubt the British and also others with equities here like the Balts, the Baltic states, and the Scandinavians who felt, you know, because of their land border threatened. I mean, they were out and strong before it was apparent that the invasion was faltering because of bad Russian logistics and tactics.
But it is true to say, and we'll have to move on to another subject just in before we go, but it is true to say that it's easy to forget how slow in some ways and how iterative that support has become. It's got stronger over time, and more arms have come, and greater resolve has come, and greater unity has come.
True.
But there was a lot of equivocation, and what we say in footy is short steps toward the ball rather than really rushing into it.
Well, I mean, and my point is that on the part of some of the West, yes, yeah. Most obviously
France.
The Americans. Yeah, well, yeah. France yeah. too, but yeah. but most obviously, I mean, it was the Americans who famously offered to evacuate
exactly.
Zelensky and his family, to which he, you know, wrote his name into every, in book of quotations for yeah. till the end of time with his response, I need ammunition, not a ride.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't offer to evacuate Zelensky and his family unless you were prepared to give up on it at the start, which Biden evidently was, and it was Zelensky's political
Precisely.
And personal courage, because he knew they were the Wagner assassins were hunting him in Kiev as he
and
as
they
he
were
said those
pre-positioned
words.
There. Yeah, yeah, no, that's absolutely right.
That was the turning point in saying, no, we are not going. This is not going to be like Afghanistan. We are going to stand and fight.
Yeah, and it really did set the tone, and it's a tone that has been consistently set since. And even, and I'm sure this will be the case in Vilnius if he's there. I assume he's going to be.
He
arrives in his T-shirt and his fatigues. And the visual message, no matter how salubrious, how prestigious, how formal the gathering is of world leaders, Zelensky is always wearing, you know, that green T-shirt. And I think it's a really impressive point he's making here. I am a leader at war.
Yeah.
And don't ever forget it. I'm not going to roll up in a suit and sort of be in some other frame.
And I know you want to get onto other topics, but can I just make this point about Zelensky? I'm sorry to say I've never met, but he's so clever. People heard that this guy was a comedian who got elected as president of Ukraine some years ago, and they were sort of ha ha ha. And then he was very unpopular until the invasion happened, and then obviously things changed massively. But the thing you've got to remember about Zelensky is he wasn't just a comedian; he was actually an entrepreneur. He owned and ran the production company which produced that TV comedy, Servant of the People, in which he was also the star. He's I was talking to Vasyl Miroshnichenko, who knows him very well, the Ukraine ambassador to Australia the other day about this. Zelensky is a really, really smart guy, and he absolutely knows, partly from his background in the entertainment industry, and in this way he resembles perhaps Ronald Reagan, he knows how to kind of strike exactly the right posture in those sort of informal ways, like, as you say, Mark, like the military attire. And I'll give you another example. I was in the House of Commons in the gallery when only a few weeks after the invasion, when he addressed the House of Commons by video link from Kiev, and it was, you know, still the expectation was that the Russians were going to prevail.
Mm.
And in his speech, his peroration, he said things like, "We are going to fight the Russians in the pasture lands of Ukraine, and we're going to fight them." And he could have quoted Churchill, right? He could have said, "We'll fight them on the beaches, we'll fight them on the landing grounds, we'll fight them on the fields and the hills." But he didn't quote Churchill. What he did was he used words that resembled what Churchill had said. And you know what? All these members of the House of Commons turned to each other and said, "Gosh, he sounds just like Churchill."
Yeah.
Now, that's so clever. And that was performative. And I mean, he obviously is when it comes to the performative arts.
Yeah, he does that. Like when he speaks in Poland, he uses Polish imagery. When he spoke in Australia, he uses Australian imagery. He's very good
He is very impressive. And what's going on there, we should never forget, is the unlawful, immoral, disgusting, atrocious annihilation of civilians. And it is, you know, we should never have a discussion about Ukraine and brush over the fact that a state has rolled into another state illegally and has been bombing civilian targets as part of its, you know, very much part of its core strategy. And it is flagrantly disgusting in every possible way you can imagine. Now, I want to just go on very quickly, because we've sort of eaten up most of our time, but I want to just go on to another subject, which is the Liberal Party. You wrote about this very interestingly recently, George, and there'd been a fair bit of commentary about, you know, the challenge that's faced by the Liberal Party, the number of inner metropolitan seats it has, for example. Your point was, and I'll just get you to expand on this, your point was it's not just demographics, it's geography. I wonder if you could just speak to that.
Well, by that, the point I was making is that everybody says, well, you know, the Liberal Party is losing the demographic wars because young people don't vote for it. Well, that's true, but 'twas ever thus.
It's just there's more of them.
But I think geography, where the votes are, is a very important and sometimes underappreciated part of the issue. Now, what is to me as a lifelong Liberal, I've been a member of the Liberal Party for 50 years, what is shocking to me is how few seats the Liberal Party has in the capital cities.
Mm.
And let me illustrate the point by giving you a horrifying, from a Liberal Party point of view, a horrifying statistic. The Liberal Party has more federal seats in regional Queensland, that is in all of Queensland, without exception, with the exception of Brisbane, than it has in all of the 8 state and territory capitals put together. And so much of the discussion has been about the loss of the inner city seats, the Kooyongs and the Wentworths and so on, which is a big problem. I'm not for a moment saying it's not. But just as big a problem, as was illustrated and dramatised by the Aston by-election, is the disconnect from suburban Australia, not, you know, the classic marginals that swing either way in the outer suburbs of the cities, the famous mortgage belt, and not the inner city seats that were traditionally prosperous but are having a deep demographic change, but that middle belt of seats, which were usually pretty pretty reliable conservative voting seats, and not just in Melbourne, but in virtually every capital city. They've gone to the Labor Party, or in some cases, in the case of 3 seats in Brisbane itself,
to the Greens.
To the Greens.
Mm. I mean, this is a long-term shift in the Liberal Party. I mean, that process has been underway for maybe 3 decades, right? You know, I think when John Howard was Prime Minister, or just after he lost, there were more regional seats in Liberal hands than in the National Party's hands, for example.
That's been the case for a long time.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you've put the point really starkly right about the sort of concentration of, I guess, you know, the people who are actually in the party room coming from regional Queensland, in effect. Like they're the dominant group reinforced by the National Party, which is also a strongly Queensland-based party. So I guess my question to you is, a long-time veteran of, you know, internal Liberal Party politics as a prominent member of the moderate faction, what hope is there for the moderates to sort of, I guess, robustly engage in a debate that might entice those voters from the sort of, you know, reliable Astons of the world and your seats in Kooyong and your mortgage belts, if there isn't really much scope for a vibrant discussion internally to test ideas?
I think there's scope for a vibrant discussion internally. I think Dutton's been very good at including, you know, following the example of John Howard, including more conservative and more moderate voices. But the moderate voices have tended to come from the city electorates, and they just aren't.
Or from the Senate.
Or from the Senate, and quite right. And there just aren't as many of them. Now, but let me give you two examples. So in the last couple of weeks, there have been state conferences of the Liberal Party or the LNP in both New South Wales and Queensland. At the New South Wales State Conference, they elected as their new state president, Jason Falinski, a very prominent moderate who lost his seat, McKellar, I think it was, to Attiel, yeah. At the last election. And the moderate faction of the New South Wales Liberal Party is absolutely in control. It's not unchallenged, of course, but it certainly is the dominant faction. As I said in another of my Sydney Morning Herald columns after the New South Wales election, it was due to the influence of people like Matt Keane that the New South Wales Liberals didn't, at the state election, suffer the sort of Teal experience and lose their heartland seats to the Teals on the Northern Beaches.
That I agree. Example. That proves Maria's point, though, doesn't it, really? That if you can get that message out, and Matt Keane did that very, very stridently, and he pushed back publicly. We haven't seen that kind of pushback. Birmingham.
Can I just quickly make this point?
Birmingham made some very strident comments from the airport the morning after the election, where he talked about climate change and where the coalition had been on that over a long period of time and what voters had said and how there needed to be a recalibration of the position. Mm. Dutton had the best cover possible then in the lee of that election as the new leader to effectively declare the climate wars over, to accept that the voters wanted had just fairly decisively, when you consider the Labor, Greens and Teal vote together, had fairly decisively voted for more rapid addressing of this question. He could have done that then, and he would have removed a very significant reason for re-electing the Teals had he adjusted the Liberal Party position on it. He chose not to. Birmingham's gone silent. There is no federal sense of a Matt Keane.
I'm not going to be drawn on that. I do have some views about it. But
we'll have to wait for the call.
Indeed. But can I just point out that when the leading moderate is in the Senate, as Senator Birmingham is the leading moderate now, obviously, in the federal parliamentary Liberal Party, they get a lot less traction because of the way Parliament works than when they're in the House of Representatives. You know, think about the days when Christopher Pyne, for example, was I think in terms of just the way power works in Canberra, you're always in a weaker position as a senior figure when you're in the Senate than in the House of Representatives.
But he is government leader. He is opposition leader in the Senate.
That's true, indeed. I was talking about the New South Wales Liberal Party. Last weekend, there was the state conference of the LNP, and they had, along with the state conference, a pre-selection for the Senate. They re-endorsed at number one on the Senate ticket with a vote of something like 99%, Senator Paul Scar, a good friend of mine who was a leading moderate, and they dumped that lunatic, what's his name?
Jared Rennick?
Jared Rennick. Thank you. I couldn't even remember his name. But from the Senate ticket, and in his place put somebody who wasn't a lunatic. So, you know, the last – so, yeah, I mean
– he's not been an ornament.
So here's some field evidence from the last couple of weeks, right?
Yeah, sure. But
in New South Wales and in Queensland, it was a good outing for the moderates.
But we started off talking about the message people take in, say, the Voice debate, right? The message people take about the coalition, particularly because oppositions don't get the spread and coverage and penetration that governments do, as you've just noted, and even less so in the Senate and so forth. But the message that voters are getting about the coalition at the moment is that it has not changed its position on climate, it has not changed its position on women, which is another sort of question. There has been some progress on the anti-corruption question, that's true. There was a degree of bipartisanship there in the end. And I just think, yes, it's all very well for moderates to say, well, like, you know, John Howard Dutton is putting moderates into positions. He understands the notion of a broad church. But he's not, hopefully, one imagines from the moderates' point of view, buying their silence in that process.
No, I don't think so. I think Peter is...
Well, where's the evidence that the moderates are speaking out?
Remember, when you lose an election, and my own view is that the election the Liberal Party lost last year was arguably its worst ever federal loss.
I think empirics are there.
We're unanimous on that.
Not by volume of seats. It wasn't a landslide to the Labor Party by any means, but because of the number of seats they lost to the Teals.
Mm, and which, by the way,
wouldn't have been lost by Malcolm Turnbull.
No, I know.
Because Malcolm, you know, was particularly on the empowerment of women. It was one of his absolute signature issues, and he had a lot of credibility about it. Now, when you go into opposition after a thumping defeat, the first obligation of the new leader is to hold the party together.
Yeah, I understand.
And the people you've got to hold together are the people who are left.
Yeah.
Now, at the moment, the people who are left last year are from the more conservative side of the party. Yeah. But, I mean, I know Peter Dutton has gone out of his way to keep the moderates in the tent. And if there is one political former Liberal Party leader who Dutton copies into or admires and seeks to emulate in terms of the way he runs things, it's John Howard. And it's exactly what John used to do.
Yeah. Okay. Final question, and we have to be very brief on this because I'm in trouble for going for so long here. Should Scott Morrison now fold his tent? Fold his tent. Go.
I'll fold his tent. I don't think so. He was elected as the member for Cook, and he has responded to the Robodebt Royal Commission. Now, I'm not calling into question anything it decided, but I think as a general proposition, people who are elected to Parliament should serve out their term unless circumstances prevail which makes it inappropriate for them to stay, and I don't think the fact that a royal commission has made these findings against him and begun a process which we are yet to see, A, whether it involves him personally, and B, what it
can't be helping. Can't be helping Peter Dutton, though, having him there and having these issues drag on and having, in a sense, you know, his kind of defiance.
Mark, you're asking me to say should Scott
Morrison. Would it be politically better, I suppose, is what I'm asking you, for him to go? And let's face it, leaders are sort of sui generis in this. They contest the election as prime minister, so it's understandable if they're not prime minister anymore. It's been a tradition that they nick off.
I don't. Well, that's not always the case.
It's certainly not the case in Britain, but it is mostly the case here.
It hasn't been the case in Australia. I mean, Gough Whitlam had the biggest Labor defeat in history in 1975, and he was elected leader of the opposition and went on to have the second biggest Labor defeat in 1977.
Yeah, no, we're going back away.
Billy McMahon stayed in Parliament for years.
I'd say Whitlam was probably the last to do that, and after Fraser, that tradition.
I don't think it's a tradition.
I liked Julia Gillard's point when she finally was confronted by Rudd the second, you know, when he came back at her and she said, all right, we'll have a party ballot, but whoever loses has to leave the parliament. I thought that was a pretty reasonable proposition.
I mean, people like us who are very close to politics and find it endlessly fascinating love the talk about by-elections. I think, you know, the average punter in Cook would think that having a by-election in Cook would be a pain in the neck.
Oh, well, that's almost certainly true. George Brandis, thanks for coming in and talking to us on Democracy Sausage.
Pleasure,
being a
Mark.
Good sport about it all, and really appreciate it. It's been a really fascinating discussion. I think we've covered quite a lot, Maria.
We sure have. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's been really good fun. And that's it for this week. If you want to give us any feedback, our email address is democracysausage@anu.edu.au. Until next week, bye for now.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.